Hello, I'm Mick Caldwell, and welcome along to The Fourth Estate, your weekly independent radio show dedicated to the coverage of media and its respective players. Today on the show,
as Eric Lutenberg, a European scholar, described radio, internet-only radio, as sovereign media. It's media that I have set up for myself, and if you want to join my community media online, that's fine, but if you don't, that's cool.
We decide to log on to the radio frequency and how it's going online ahead of the forward-thinking community radio industry conference called Technorama. And we get the no-holds-barred industry perspective as to what the situation is like for filmmakers currently in Australia looking to get their big break. So stay tuned with me over the next half hour for these stories, plus so much more here on The Fourth Estate. Federal Minister for Communications, Broadband and the Digital Economy, Stephen Conroy, has called for an overhaul into current Indigenous broadcasting practices, with the government encouraging talks between SBS and the existing community network, National Indigenous Television Service, to potentially create a third digital SBS channel. This new channel would provide a national free-to-air platform dedicated to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander-derived content without the need to create a third national broadcaster. While NITV is supportive of the merger, it's also keen to ensure the new channel would be under Indigenous editorial control. The SBS board is currently reviewing the proposal and will report back to the government. The Fourth Estate's Dylan Barber spoke to the NITV chairman, Ken Rays.
What do you think of the plans for a merger between NITV and SBS, and how important is it for NITV to move to free-to-air broadcasting?
NITV moving to free-to-air broadcasting is one of the imperatives right from the outset. One of the concerns that we had right from the start was that the government certainly wasn't going to give us a broadcasting licence. We couldn't then therefore, start to budge harder for a channel to go with it. And therefore our platforms had been all but free-to-air. And of course the positive of this proposal is free-to-air, no doubt. From the NITV perspective, significant win. The government certainly has indicated that their preferred position would be for, Indigenous television to go to a dedicated channel in SBS, free-to-air. Great. But all the other issues about how we ensure that there is going to remain Indigenous editorial control, these sorts of things, those are the issues that we're still, sitting around tables negotiating all that sort of stuff. So it's not there yet. Certainly not there. We've got more things to put to the table and to negotiate with the SBS in terms of future NITV arrangements and how we work forward.
Now, Senator Stephen Conroy has said the merger will allow Indigenous television to continue its evolution without the creation of a third national broadcaster. I mean, would you rather a new national broadcaster be devoted to Indigenous content? Is that a reality?
I certainly believe that it should be that way in terms of what we've achieved in the short term and what the objective is in respect of Australian television landscape, if you like. If we're looking at Australian Indigenous content that is available, that is now being screened and presented as a service through NITV, and it's still evolving and developing, compared to what Indigenous content is or how it exists in other services in the country, we're the best. There's no doubt about that. So why shouldn't there be a dedicated situation in your own country about Indigenous content and television? I think it offers all Australians a great option, a diversity that a lot of us haven't seen.
In November last year, there were talks even of NITV becoming a subsidiary of the ABC. Why was that rejected?
That was talk. That was all the innuendo going on when the review was happening. The review undertaken by the government of the Indigenous Broadcasting Program, which is everything, radio and television. And of course, NITV was part of that process. And in there, there was that proposal by the ABC to consume NITV into its arrangements. But if you looked at the finite details of that arrangement, they're actually, you know, suggesting that NITV content be programmed on their extra channel from 9 p.m. at night, you know, through the wee hours. You know, that's third world stuff in terms of where we're at.
Despite what platform it is on or whether it's a broadcaster, how important is it to ensure that Indigenous perspectives and stories are told across a national platform?
Oh, it's absolutely important, and I think NITV since its inception and where it stands today has demonstrated that. You know, some statistics that we got from a qualified research organisation 3 weeks ago indicated that there were 400,000 Australians watched NITV in that particular week. Now they're obviously looking at NITV as being informative, education. You know, we've got different genres. We've got kids programs, language programs, stories about, you know, remote Aboriginal Australia and, you know, the communities out there and stories and so on, which people do become interested in when they sit down and watch what is being presented on our service. So it has merit, it is gaining better merit, and it's limited at this point in time because it's not free-to-air around other parts of Australia.
You mentioned the merits of the initiative. Would the new channel then contribute to the government's Closing the Gap policy objectives?
Well, we would hope so, because that's exactly what we're trying to do and endeavour to do with the government in terms of have that partnership with government to ensure that we are closing the gap. We've always indicated to government that that's our objective as well as an Indigenous television service, to help that process occur.
Now, folding the NITV services into SBS will create a number of, you know, great operational efficiencies and provide wider distribution, but it does spell the end of a completely independent Indigenous broadcaster. You mentioned editorial controls. What sort of other requirements would you want met if these plans go ahead?
Oh, look, there are a range of things. You know, we certainly have editorial policies that we believe are paramount. You know, we've got first lot of Indigenous news and current affairs programs that are happening at the moment. You know, we need to ensure that continues. It goes beyond that. You know, you've got the staffing issues. The team that drives the service today needs to be given some sureties about, you know, how the service is to be driven into the future and their involvement. If this proposal can be shown to lead, you know, better outcomes for Indigenous television and for Indigenous Australians, By all means, we sit down and negotiate, you know, a way forward positively. And there are a few options that we are thinking of, you know, in how do we move this forward and to ensure these key issues are in fact taken into account.
And I guess finally, this is, as we've said, an important step for Indigenous television. But what do you see as the future of Indigenous broadcasting in the long term?
Well, you know, I hazard to say that I hope that, I truly hope, and I'm not trying to be, you know, sinister in any way here, I hope that we're big enough in this country to accept the fact that, you know, there is, as in, say, New Zealand and others, you know, Maori television and so on, and other countries have got dedicated Indigenous television services that are controlled and run by, you know, Indigenous peoples of those countries. I hope that will remain. SBS is, you know, it's our national multicultural television service, isn't it? And I think that there is a difference between Indigenous people and multiculturalism in this country. And I think all Australians need to recognise that.
That was Ken Reyes, Chairman of the National Indigenous Television Service, or NITV, speaking to Dylan Barber. Frontman from Queen, Freddie Mercury, once pondered Radio What's New, the internet and its increasing number of stations purely dedicated to online content. Internet radio stations are paving the way for an alternative to the norm. They vary, ranging from student community-based broadcasting to non-stop dance music, and hold firm in setting themselves apart from the traditional wireless broadcaster. Annie Wiley spoke to Andrea Baker, lecturer in journalism at Monash University, as well as the author of the recently published Virtual Radio Gaga, Youths and Net Radio.
What is the difference between broadcasting purely on the internet and having a frequency in that more traditional radio sense?
I think that's a really good question, because I think really what it comes back to is defining internet radio, because what often happens is the two different definitions get lumped in together, and then that results in confusion. What we are listening to with 2SER is radio online. So that is traditional radio that has got a government license, and therefore it is regulated, but is also using the internet as an adjunct. Now, the other one, which is more interesting, which I think is more seductive, which is really coming out of my research a lot, is the formation of internet-only radio, where this is radio that streams only online, and up until 2001, it was not regulated at all. I mean, there was no government licenses for these stations, etc. The only regulation that came into play in 2001, and it was mostly US-driven, was music copyright. The high difference is between the regulation. And the difference is with that regulation, that means you don't have to answer to anybody. I mean, that's where it becomes an individual, sovereign media form of seduction.
So do you think that focus of music on internet radio is sort of an overall focus in terms of they don't focus on talks because they want to push the boundaries, or you know, it's just kind of emerged like that music has been the main focus?
I mean, ironically, the first internet-only radio station, which came out of California, was called Talk Radio, but really why it was set up was to promote emerging artists, musicians, namely. And there were a series of radio stations, internet-only, that were talk-based but didn't survive for years, because what they were actually were doing were mimicking traditional radio. So, yes, they wanted to do something which was less dull, more experimental, and not the same as traditional radio. I mean, I would say internet-only radio is a rebellion against commercial and traditional radio. And sorry to say, it's a slight rebellion against community radio also. How it's come up different from traditional radio is music. But it had to find something different. Just like, you know, when television came into play, radio had to find something different to survive against television.
You mentioned Pulse Radio.
Mm.
They stream from all over the world. It's kind of a transnational contribution. Do you think this creates a sense of community within the radio world across borders?
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, there's no set station. You know, basically, they're actually doing their little show from their bedroom or their lounge room. So it's a virtual community of radio people where there's no central station, as you know, except probably the server, which is like 360 or shout.com. Yes, I mean, it's basically the new way. There's a really strong argument in the communications world about whether internet-only radio is radio, because it is multimedia. It has got that convergence of radio, television and online text, which people love.
Is it difficult to establish an internet radio station compared to, say, establishing a traditional radio station?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, you're looking at least, you know, 80,000 set up a station, and then you have to get, I'd say, government licenses, if you're lucky to get a government license and sponsors, etc. You know, if you just had to do it a ballpark figure, 80,000 for a traditional radio station, 3,000 to 20,000 for a small internet radio station, depending whether you do it at home or do it with a group of people. There's people that I interviewed in New York City, guys in the 20s, early 20s, college students, set up their own station at home for about $5,000. They bought a computer with a good hard drive. It can hold about 5,000 songs a day. And then with Radio Monash, the reason why we set up our internet-only station is because we did go for various licenses over the years. Radio Monash has been going since the 60s. And in 2001, the Victorian legislation, they gave the license to SYNFM, because that would encompass all, you know, use between 12 to 28, and so therefore they more or less said, well, Radio Monash people can go with them if you want to, but that's on the other side of the city here. And we started to set up our own internet-only station in 2001, and we could have applied for a license again, but we thought, no, internet-only is more avant-garde, more revolutionary, more seductive, and there's freedom. There's complete freedom. It's your own media. As Eric Glutenberg, a European scholar, described radio, internet-only radio, as sovereign media. It's media that I have set up for myself because I'm really interested in dance music, and if you want to join my community media online, that's fine, but if you don't, that's cool.
Is internet radio something that is more for the youth? You've sort of mentioned Radio Monash and, you know, emerging artists and stuff like that. Do you think that a lot more youth are latching on to internet radio rather than the older generation?
That came out in the initial research, but I think that is changing. And the reason why I mostly targeted university students in my research, not because I work at a university, is because the very first industry research about internet-only radio that came out of New York City showed that it was college students who were interested in it because they were disillusioned with traditional radio and its mainstream music formats. But that aside, no. I'd say initially, youths, yes, they were interested, and that's the same at the beginning of the century. In the 1800s, it was young people that were interested in establishing radio in general. But there was a growing group. I mean, I'm from Gen X, you know. I'm very interested in internet radio. I know a lot of baby boomer friends, if I had to put a generational slant on this. And ABC set up the first internet-only radio station called Dig, and they set that up for the audience between 30 to 50. I mean, yes, I mean, in hindsight, the majority of the time, the internet-only radio that's about emerging artists is very much tied to the youth culture, because in my generation, we are interested in emerging artists, but we're probably also interested in established artists.
Finally, do you think that internet radio will continue to expand with the growth of digital radio?
Yes, but the thing is also, digital radio has latched on to internet radio. When old stereo became digital radio, they had radar and pink stations, which were adjunct to their analog stations. But also what they did, they put them online. Digital radio will be slow to take up because the analog turn-off will be slow. I think it won't be until maybe even 2013 here, and then people won't bother buying a digital radio until they finally can't get their signal. But I think internet-only radio uptake was quick and fast and still emerging because everybody's online. Really, internet radio will probably continue to be the platform, and digital radio will adopt the internet to promote itself.
Journalism lecturer Andrea Baker was speaking there to Annie Wiley about the future for internet radio. And although we adhere to the more traditional notions of wireless broadcasting, if you do want to get your hands on any past or present editions of the Fourth Estate, our website is 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. The gossip pages have been abuzz lately, with talk of Hollywood A-listers landing in Sydney to commence production on acclaimed director Baz Luhrmann's latest project, The Great Gatsby. But for many in the local filmmaking business, the hype has been met with a considerable amount of bitterness, as the project received much sought-after funding from industry body Screen Australia. But with film festivals emerging across the country almost every week, director of the Sydney Underground Film Festival, Stefan Popescu, begins this report.
Authorship is not really valued in this country. You know, we like the idea that film can be an industry, but, you know, we haven't even got kind of that one right yet. It's like, you know, come on, make up your mind. You're going to fund, so they could easily fund really small films like for $20,000 or $30,000. Like, my features don't cost more than, what was the last one? Yeah, it was actually $10,000. And then by the time you add up posts and stuff, it's about $20,000.
For the director of the Sydney Underground Film Festival, Stephen Popescu, has found himself all too often finding his film proposals in the too hard basket, when realistically a little grant could potentially go a long way.
So you could easily fund these weird little productions that would easily make that as a return. I don't understand where their sort of business strategies are at and stuff, because that could actually harbour a lot of sort of a bit of a nice community and culture around cinema, so I don't know where they're at.
But all too often, it is this disheartened attitude that inhibits budding Spielbergs from moving ahead. Bradley Patrick, the artistic director of the Breath of Fresh Air Film Festival in Launceston, Tasmania.
Be proactive. It's like learn about the films that you want to make, the stories that you want to tell, and, you know, just move forward in that area. It's like every single day is a learning experience. And, you know, I think a lot of the film schools, they're all great to teach you the theory and so forth of filmmaking. Unless you're actually on the set of a film, whether it be a short film or a TV commercial or so forth, you have to have that on-the-ground experience to really move your career forward. And, you know, whether you need to move to another country like New York, or, you know, or another city like New York or LA, I don't think you need to do that. I think you just need to surround yourself with people that are positive and in the industry. And, you know, everyone is pretty collaborative in the film industry. I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, there's no money around or Australian stories are really bleak, but I don't really believe that. I think that's just the media build up. Great films coming out of Australia and some amazing talent. I mean, the last sort of 30 years there's been prolific Oscar winners, from, you know, John Seale to Peter Weir to Roger Deakins to Russell Boyd to, you know, Dean Semler. I mean, you know, put the spotlight on Australia and, you know, it really sets the tone for when people, you know, explore other things overseas. They know that Australia has pedigree in the film industry. It tells me a little bit about when you work on a film, and because of how it's marketed and how it's distributed, it doesn't get an audience. Kind of like you've spent 6 months doing a movie and nobody's seen it. You really have to have a great support team around you to, you know, take it to the next level. So whether it's a festival circuit or, you know, an independent cinema chain or...
It is this lack of market savvy that all too often sells that perfect film pitch short of gaining distribution, says Anne-Marie J. Bell, producer of Azure Productions, keynote speaker at the annual Metro Screen Industry Talks held in Sydney, offering her own experiences in how to market a film successfully.
So it's really about knowing what do you want to achieve from the marketplace. Are you going to see movies? Are you going to meet people? Are you going to pitch a film? You know, what is the purpose of it? It is important to know who's going to watch your movie. You know, everyone always talks about audience, audience, audience. But I think there's a lot of lip service given to audience.
She advises any would-be filmmakers to get down to basics before putting proposals out there.
Where am I going to see my film? Do I want it at Dendy? Do I want it at George Street? Who do I think is my audience? And you can just think local, because local is global. Like, I know we talk about that with rubbish and all that other stuff, but it's the same with films. You know, think locally and, you know, it just transcends globally.
How do you feel about, I mean, the fact that, I'm very excited, the fact that now you can purchase online, you know, an $8,000 high-definition camera and go out and make a feature. Like, you don't need to worry about getting $5 million anymore. Any of this sort of stuff is gone. You can do it on a MacBook Pro. So would you accept if I went out and made a film and a feature and then I brought it to you and said, I need distribution, is that a lot of people doing that now?
Not so much to me as a producer, because they've already made the film, and a lot of people think that all a producer does is bring money to the table. I mean, a producer, you know, is very creative and we are a collaborator. I think it's fantastic that we can have all sorts of different movies. I mean, just because a movie's made with a low-end camera, I think it's fantastic, because it's just talking to an audience, which is a different audience to the same people who go and see, you know, some other big movie that's playing, like Harry Potter's a different audience. You're not going to have the same two. That's great.
Anne-Marie J. Bell is a self-made film producer of Azure Productions. Ending that report from Marty Lewis. The Sydney Underground Film Festival is showcasing some cinematic greats, so check it all out at suff.com.au. That gave a little bit of an industry perspective into the current situation for filmmaking in Australia. And that is the end of another week's edition of The Fourth Estate, and a chance for us to give thanks to the financial support that keeps The Fourth Estate on the airwaves, that is offered up by the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University and the Humanities and Social Sciences Department at UTS. And FYI, we are now finally in the realm of true online networking with The Fourth Estate Facebook page, new and ready for your approval, including controversial discussion topics, as well as some quirky tidbits that I've sourced out from the World Wide Web, and I would love to hear from you. Any ideas or insights or just a bit of feedback, it's always appreciated on the show. And hashtag this one for later, 4TH Estate Radio is on Twitter. So with all that in mind, we will catch you again throughout the week across the blogosphere, and I will be with you again the same time next week for more stories on the media. My name is Meg Caldwell, and this was the Fourth Estate. Until next time, take care.